We're working on, about to work on Leviticus 22. We're moving out of chapter 21. And this chapter contains a series of rules about priests and their families eating the food sacrificed to Yahweh. Remember that the priest's chief food supply was those things that were brought by the people of Israel for sacrifice in the tabernacle and later on in the temple. Now, what is also noteworthy is that a direct parallel is drawn between the requirement of perfection for the priests who offer the sacrifices and for the sacrificial animals themselves. Even the description of the nature of the banned blemishes on priests and on the sacrificial animals is similar. Look at the list of defects that ends chapter 21. Neither priest nor animal can come before the Lord, meaning they could not take their roles in the sacrificial process, if any of the following defects were noted: blindness, a broken or injured arm or leg, scurvy, running sores, a limb which is too long or too short, crushed or missing testicles, or a growth in the eye. God's definition of perfection, which is synonymous with the phrase, without blemish, is what is being defined in this list of disqualifying defects. It is clear that no priest, no animal was ever utterly perfect. It's instructive for our understanding of this requirement for perfection that the modern day rabbis who are actively searching for that perfect red heifer, since the Jews returned to the Holy Land, have yet to find one. This is because it is the rabbis who have defined what perfect means for the red heifer, and that standard so far has fallen short. My point is, we have to approach the supposed physical perfection of priests and sacrificial animals with some common sense. Yahweh sets down definitions of perfection that were broad enough to allow for the natural variations and built-in imperfections that occur among all humans and animals, without being so wrapped up in punctilious detail that nothing could ever hope to qualify. The blemishes we see listed are the most obvious, they're the most easily detectable, and so they affected only a rather small fraction of the population of both priests and clean animals. And without detouring just yet, let me also point out that this attention to detail bordering on the absurd went far beyond that which God had ordained. Because this man-made definition of perfection was more opinion and personal preference and intellectualism than divine decree. It was this system of tradition gone wild that Yeshua was constantly referring to when he complained about the burden of the law. It was the rabbis' laws, not God's laws, that Yeshua was speaking against, not the very same law that Christ himself had made. It was man's ridiculous rules and regulations that were unachievable. Now that said, is it not fascinating that Messiah would eventually fulfill not only all the requirements for the perfect priest, but for the perfect sacrificial animal substitute as well? A level of perfection that was so far beyond man's ability to comprehend that it had to be God himself that took on the role of the high priest and of the atoning sacrifice. Now let's take a look at a few of those New Testament verses that connect these commandments of Leviticus with Yeshua's purpose. The first one begins in the book of Hebrews, chapter 7. Book of Hebrews, chapter 7, beginning at verse 23. Moreover, the present priests are many in number because they are prevented by death from continuing in office. But because he lives forever, His position as priest, speaking of Christ, does not pass on to someone else. And consequently, he is totally able to deliver those who approach God through him, since he is alive forever and thus forever able to intercede on their behalf. This is the kind of high priest that meets our need, holy, without evil, without stain, set apart from sinners, raised higher up than the heavens, one who does not have the daily necessity, like the other high priests, of offering up sacrifices first for their own sins and only then for those of the people. Because he offered one sacrifice, once and for all, by offering up himself. Because the Torah appoints a high priest, for the Torah appoints a high priest men who have weaknesses. But the text which speaks about the swearing of the oath, a text written later than the Torah, appoints a son who has been brought to that goal forever. See, here is a detailed explanation comparing the Levite priests, more specifically the high priest, to Jesus and to his ministry. Yeshua became the permanent high priest upon his death and resurrection. Not like a high priest, but as a high priest. And this is because a high priest, a mediator, is still needed to make intercession on our behalf. Moving down to Hebrews chapter 9, starting at verse 11. But when the Messiah appeared as high priest of the good things that are happening already, then through the greater and more perfect tent, which is not man-made, that is, it's not of this created world, he entered the holiest place once and for all. And he entered not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus setting people free forever. Because of sprinkling ceremonially unclean persons with the blood of goats and bulls and ashes of a heifer restores their outward purity, then how much more the blood of the Messiah, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself to God as a sacrifice without blemish, will purify our conscience from works that lead to death, so that we can serve the living God. It is because of this death that he is mediator of a new covenant, because a death has occurred which sets people free from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. Those who have been called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. And I want you to notice that last verse. I hope you would open your Bibles. Because a death has occurred which sets people free from what? The transgressions committed under the first covenant. Not abolish the first covenant, therefore getting rid of transgressions. It's a whole different ballgame. You see the difference? Just as Yeshua is the high priest, he is also compared to the sacrificial animals, goats, bulls, heifers, that he replaces with himself. Now notice it also defines exactly which sins or transgressions that his blood atones for. It says again, the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, the law of Moses, the law of the Torah. The new covenant deals with how atonement is achieved and who is included among those that are permitted to use this new level of atonement for sin. And this new and unprecedented level is Christ's blood, because it is applied once and for all, with the caveat that the permitted group who may take advantage of this permanent method of atonement is only those who trust in what Christ did. All others are excluded. So let's be very clear about what's happening here that is so vividly stated and yet routinely it's misused. We commit sins, Messiah's blood makes our atonement. I have a very simple question for you. What is sin? What's sin? It's a transgression against the first covenant. Christ just told us. That's all it is. What is the first covenant? The law of Moses, the Torah. That's what sin is. We've tried to make it out to be all kinds of things. Oh, it's whatever God told me. No, God is not going to tell you something different than what he has written in his Bible. See, the New Testament story of Jesus is about a new level of atonement, not a new law. From an earthly sense, and as compared to human civil government, it's as though we retain all the same laws on our books, and we even determine that all the punishments are going to remain the same as well. However, now somebody else, a volunteer, can pay all those fines. They can serve all that jail time for us. They can even take our place in the death chamber. How do I know that's the case? How do I know for sure that both the law and its penalties remain, that only the penalty has been transferred to Yeshua to bear it for those who trust him? Let me give you that piece of the puzzle now that we've read Hebrews. Matthew 5:17. Don't think I've come to abolish the Torah or the prophets. I've not come to abolish, but to complete. Yes, indeed, I tell you that heaven and earth passes away, not so much as a jot or a stroke is going to pass from the Torah, not till everything that must happen has happened. So whoever disobeys the least of these commandments and teaches others to do so, they're going to be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever obeys them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. How much more plain spoken can it get? If Christ abolished the laws themselves, then most certainly much more than a small letter or a stroke's been changed. If Christ kept the laws but abolished the penalty, think about this, for breaking the law, then most certainly something greater than a small letter or a stroke has changed. But he said not the tiniest piece of it was going to pass. And I'll take his word for it. Instead, some of the law has transformed, for lack of a better word, for those who trust him. For one thing, he becomes our sacrifice and our high priest once and for all. Even more, he has accomplished for us, his bride, the requirement that we've been reading about throughout Leviticus. We must be perfect if we're going to be part of Yeshua's priesthood, because being a priest means having access to God that other people don't have. Listen to this in Ephesians 5:25. As for husbands, love your wives, just as the Messiah loved the Messianic community. Indeed, he gave himself up on its behalf in order to set it apart for God, making it clean through immersion in the mikveh, so to speak, in order to present the Messianic community to himself as a bride to be proud of, without spot, without wrinkle or any such thing, but wholly without defect. We have been declared perfect, blemish free, the bride of the high priest. And his spiritual living water that makes us clean accomplished this. You see, blemishes and defects weren't necessarily sin, but they were uncleanness. But these blemishes and defects could become sin if we presented something to God that has blemishes and was full of defects, like ourselves, for instance. And the way that happens is when we present our blemished lives and works so riddled with all of their defects and say to God that by means of my own efforts and my character, I think I'm good enough to commune with him. I think I'm good enough, God, to come into your heaven. Well, Yeshua had to help us in two primary ways. First of all, he atoned for our sinful natures and sinful behavior by means of his blood. And second, Christ purified us from uncleanness by his living water. How amazingly this fits utterly hand in glove with all we've been learning in one of the most neglected, if not despised, books by Christians in the entire Bible, Leviticus. I get more positive comments from the book of, from my studies on the book of Leviticus on the internet than any other book. It has meant so much to people. They now understand much, much more what Christ did for us. I tell you truly, there is no way to grasp the depth of what happens under the new covenant without first understanding the Torah. Not possible. Let's read Leviticus chapter 22. Page 135 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Adonai said to Moses, tell Aaron and his sons to separate themselves from the holy things of the people of Israel, which they set apart as holy for me, so that they will not profane my holy name. I am Adonai. Tell them, any descendant of yours through all of your generations who approaches the holy things that the people of Israel consecrate to Adonai and is unclean, he will be cut off from before me. I am Adonai. Any descendant of Aaron with sarat or a discharge is not to eat the holy things until he's clean. Anyone who has touched a person made unclean by a dead body, or has had a seminal emission, or has touched a reptile or insect that can make him unclean, or a man who is unclean for any reason and who can transmit to him his uncleanness, the person who touches any of these things will be unclean until evening and is not to eat the holy things unless he bathes his body in water. And after sunset, he'll be clean. And afterwards, he may eat the holy things because they are his food. But he's not to eat anything that dies naturally or it's torn to death by wild animals and thereby make himself unclean. I'm Adonai. The priests must observe this charge of mine. Otherwise, if they profane it, they will bear the consequences of sin for doing so, and they'll die in it. I am Adonai who makes them holy. No one who is not a priest made anything holy, nor may a tenant or employee of a Kohen eat anything holy. But if a Kohen acquires a slave, either through purchase or through his being born into his household, he may share his food. If the daughter of a priest is married to a man who's not a priest, she's not to have a share of the food set aside from the holy thing. But if the daughter of a priest is a widow, or divorcee and has no child, and she is sent back to her father's house as when she was young, she may then share in her father's food. But no one not a priest is to share in it. If a person eats holy food by mistake, he must add 1/5 to it and give the holy food to the priest. They are not to profane the holy things of the people of Israel that they've set apart for Adonai, and thus cause them to bear guilt, requiring a guilt offering by eating these holy things, because I'm Adonai who makes them holy. Adonai said to Moses, speak to Aaron and to his sons and to the entire people of Israel and tell them, when anyone, whether a member of the house of Israel or a foreigner living in Israel, brings his offering either in connection with a vow or as a voluntary offering and brings it to Adonai as a burnt offering, in order for you to be accepted, you must bring a male without defect from the cattle, the sheep, or the goats. You're not to bring anything with a defect, because it will not be accepted from you. Whoever brings a sacrifice of peace offerings to Adonai in fulfillment of a vow, or as a voluntary offering, whether it came from the herd or from the flock, it must be unblemished without defect in order to be accepted. If it's blind or injured or mutilated or has an abnormal growth or has festering or running sores, you're not to offer it to Adonai or make such an offering by fire on the altar to Adonai. If a bull or a lamb has a limb which is too long or too short, you may offer it as a voluntary offering, but for a vow it won't be accepted. An animal with bruised, crushed, torn, or cut genitals you're not to offer to Adonai. You're not to do these things in your land. And you are not to receive any of these from a foreigner for you to offer as bread for your God, because their deformity is a defect in them. They'll not be accepted from you. Adonai said to Moses, when a bull or a sheep or a goat is born, it is to stay with its mother for 7 days. But from the eighth day on, it may be accepted for an offering made by fire to Adonai. However, no animal is to be slaughtered together with its young on the same day, neither cow nor ewe. And when you offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving to Adonai, you must do it in a way such that you will be accepted. It must be eaten on the same day it's offered. Leave none of it until morning. I'm Adonai. You are to keep my commandments and obey them. I'm Adonai. You're not to profane my holy name. On the contrary, I am to be regarded as holy among the people of Israel. I'm Adonai who makes you holy, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I'm Adonai. Now, this chapter is primarily about explaining circumstances under which priests may not officiate at sacrifices, nor can they eat the food that was brought in as sacrifices. And the first thing that is commanded is that a priest is disqualified from eating those sacred donations, those offerings, if he's in a state of impurity for some reason. It says that if a priest does eat of that food, then the penalty is he's to be cut off, karet, from the Lord. And this time, cut off does not mean that the priest is to be killed or to be sent away. It means that he's to be removed from Jehovah's presence in the sense that he's to be removed from his priestly duties. Now, starting in verse 4, we get a series of examples of things that can cause a priest to become unclean, which therefore means the priest cannot eat the food that was brought as a sacred offering. And most of the types of uncleanness mentioned require an 8-day cycle of ritual cleansing before that priest is considered clean again. But in a somewhat confusing statement, verse 6 then says that that person shall only be unclean until sunset. What gives? What happened to that 8-day cycle? The answer is that two different situations are being spoken of. The first situation is where a priest directly defiles himself by committing an act that's prohibited, such as touching a dead body or having some type of bodily discharge or having an open sore. All these things render him unclean. The second situation is one in which a priest touches someone else who is unclean. Remember that we have been taught that that uncleanness can be transmitted by touch. So the idea is touching someone who's ritually unclean defiles the priest, and that unclean person's impurity then is transmitted to the priest. The first situation of direct defilement requires the usual 8-day cycle. The second situation, because it's indirect defilement, then is just what I call a wash and a wait. All right, you immerse, you wait till sunset, you're clean again. Now, did this priest have to go hungry until he was clean again, since an unclean priest couldn't eat the holy food? No, it wasn't that he couldn't eat it all. It's just that he could not eat the sacred food. So he would have to purchase some non-sanctified food, which same food all the other Israelites ate. Now, verse 10 says, no outsider, no layperson, a non-priest, can eat the sacred offerings. Then it goes on to define just who an outsider and an insider are. And what we find out is rather instructional, because it concerns Israeli society in general. This is in verses 10 and 11. And essentially, we get 5 categories or classifications of people who might be living under the roof of a priest. And each category is then told whether or not they can share the priest's portion of holy food. Now, remember, in general, the family of a priest, including his wife and his children, are fully entitled to share in the priest's holy food portion. But Israeli society was not only different than ours today, it was actually a bit more complex. So some explanation is needed. The five categories are defined as a lay person, also called an outsider, a bound or a tenant laborer, a hired laborer, a priest purchased slave, and a person born into a priest's household. Five categories. And since different Bible versions vary all over the map as to the precise words they use to translate each of these categories, your Bible might use slightly different words than what I read to you. Now, permit me to reiterate. I want you to pay close attention to these distinctions and to these variations, because it's going to help you greatly in understanding matters all the way through the Old Testament and the New Testament. See, these classes are not well defined in the Bible. It's understood by the writer that you already know these subtleties. Therefore, the significance of each category in whatever context it's used. If we don't understand these Israeli societal and family rules, we get some awfully strange ideas about what's actually happening here. Now, the first category spoken about in verse 10 is in verse 10, and in Hebrew it concerns a zar. Now, a czar is a common Hebrew word. It just means a stranger or a foreigner. But as it's used here, it means strange in the sense of it doesn't belong. It's out of place. Now, using the term layperson is maybe the best translation for a church-going Westerner. The idea is simply that no non-priest, that's a person who is strange or foreign to the priesthood, nobody like that is permitted to eat the holy food. It also includes Levites, who were at one time priests, but they've been removed from the priesthood for some reason or another. And the one caveat to all this is that those who are considered family of the priest can eat the holy food that the priest brings home with him. The remaining four terms we're going to define basically states where that particular category is to be considered as part of the family's priest's family or not. Therefore, eligible to eat that holy food or not. Now, the second category spoken about, just a few words into verse 10, is toshav. Toshav is a kind of a broad term, and it means something like guest worker. It can mean a foreign friend of the family who's staying for a while. It can refer to a person who's being forced to live with the priest's family as a result of that person paying off a debt. Therefore, that toshav may in some cases be a Hebrew. So it could be a Hebrew or a foreigner. But toshav generally indicates no blood relationship. A toshav is not generally a family member, and by Hebrew thinking, not property of a priest, like a slave, so he or she cannot eat the priest's holy food allotment. The third category immediately follows the second. In some cases, the two are even lumped together and presented as synonyms, but they're not. In Hebrew, the third category is sakir. And sakir means a hired laborer. And that's just like we think of it. Maybe it's a day worker, a live-in maid. But the idea is this person is not a slave and they're not any kind of a bondservant that's paying off of a debt. They just have a job. And they're being paid for it. The fourth category is presented at the beginning of verse 11, where most Bible versions will say priest's property or a slave. The Hebrew uses a series of words rather than a single word to define this category. And the words are kana nefesh. Kana nefesh. Literally, it means to acquire a living being. A couple of words later, it is added that this kana nefesh, this acquired living being, was required by means of purchase with the priest's own money. So literally it says, an acquired living being purchased by money, a slave purchased from somebody. It was usually a foreign slave that was purchased, because by law, a Hebrew couldn't own another Hebrew. Now, what is key to notice is that this category of person is considered family. And therefore, against all modern logic, he or she is permitted to eat the sacred food. In other words, a purchased slave, in almost all cases not an Israelite, is considered to be part of the family. But a slave who lives with the family because they were forced to pay off a debt, a bondservant, they're not considered part of the family. A purchased slave was considered the priest's property. A bondservant is not the priest's property. I make a mental note of this, because this definition is important for the whole rest of the Bible. Now, the final category is usually described as those born into the family or household. Don't get the picture of the priest's own children here. This is not what's being talked about. The Hebrew word is Yelid Beito, and it literally means born into the household. It's not used in conjunction with the head of the household's wife giving birth to children. It is a term reserved for the children that were born from those purchased slaves, from those kana nefesh. Since several of these categories in one way or another involve servitude and slavery, I need to make clear that those slaves who were not purchased and therefore not family and not allowed to partake of the holy food that was given to the priest, they weren't starved. It just meant that food had to be purchased for them like every other Israelite. 8. Under the law, all slaves, no matter how they were acquired, no matter whether they were foreign or Hebrew, they had to be treated decently. They couldn't be abused. They couldn't be starved. They couldn't be overworked. Now, let me say this another way. Every one of these categories is discussed and defined here in Leviticus 22 because the situation was that for one reason or another, every one of these categories of people regularly wound up living in the home of a priest. And the purpose of these categories only pertains to whether or not they're entitled to eat of the sacred food portion. And as we see, some were, some weren't, and it doesn't necessarily follow in the light that we might kind of logically think of it. Now, verse 12 defines what happens if a priest's daughter marries somebody outside of the priestly line. She stops receiving the sacred food. She's joined to her husband. So her new identity is with her new husband, and it ceases to be with her natural father. Yet if something happens via death or divorce and she has no other choice but to go back and live once again under her father's roof, then she once again qualifies to eat the sacred food as a family member. Now notice the comment about an exception to the rule being if she is without offspring. The idea is if she has a son who's now old enough to care for his widowed or divorced mother, then it's his duty, according to the law, to care for her. And since he would be, by definition, not a priest, then his mother would continue to be ineligible to eat holy food. And as one can imagine, mistakes were made. And verses 13 through 15 deal with what happens when somebody accidentally eats sacred food and they weren't supposed to. And I understand that these rules apply only when it's an honest, unintentional error, not a trick, not a deception, not an outright disregard for the law. Therefore, the penalty is relatively minor, as the accidental violator must pay the value of the sacrifice plus a 20% penalty. Now, accidents and lapses are given a lot of mercy But even then, there's still a consequence. Never can anyone affront Yahweh's holiness, even if it's without malice, and be given a complete pass. We must never forget that. And I think verse 16 gives us a little hint of something that went on quite a bit among the Israelites, something that happened with regularity in most pagan cultures. At this moment in history, God was in the process of leading the Israelites out of their paganism with the giving of the Torah. And basically it says that the priests have a dual responsibility. They are to make sure that they themselves don't profane God's holy property. And secondly, they are to make sure that the ordinary Israelites don't sin for eating food to which they have no right. Now, it's easy enough to understand that part of it. But then it goes on to say, "For it's I, Yahweh, who make them sacred." And this is not a throw-in phrase. I believe that what's being addressed here is the standard pagan belief that you can make yourself holy, even godlike, if you do certain things. And one of the standard things you could do back then was to eat the food of the gods, ingest holy food, and presto, you're holy. And we've talked previously about how we see all these mentions of offerings being food for God. We've seen the smoke of the burnt offerings being called a sweet aroma for his nostrils. I've taught you that the Israelites were serious about those words. They meant them literally. In their cultural thinking, which at that time was based mostly on pagan concepts and practices born from those 4 centuries of living in Egypt, even though God didn't tell them so, it was common sense to them that God needed to eat. They figured God had a nose that liked smelling good things, because that's just how gods are. And the common element among all of these pagan societies of that era was that the animals burned up on altars was actual food for the gods. And since it was holy food, if one was to eat that food, it would transmit holiness to the one who ate it. So holiness could actually be misappropriated. That was the thinking. God was telling Israel something that he would have to tell them decade after decade. And still so much of Hebrew society didn't get it. He makes you holy. You can't sacrifice your way to holiness. Can't obey the law well enough to attain holiness. And in the current case, you can't eat your way to holiness. You can only be declared holy by the only one who has that authority, God himself. Following the laws, that brought a kind of holiness, a kind of righteousness, Paul calls it, to the worshiper, but not the saving kind, not the spiritual kind, more of an outward kind. The kind it brought was the kind that comes from obedience, the kind that comes from setting your heart on your mind on believing that what God says is true, and that real life comes from living a Torah life. But the way all this happened was that it had to come in a precise, unchangeable order. First, you have to be redeemed by God. Next, you must be declared holy by God. And then you are to, out of gratitude and awareness of the truth, follow him in obedience. That's the order. You can't reverse it. You can't change it. You can't skip a step. You have been made holy and righteous. Now, go live a holy and righteous life. Now, we're going to move very rapidly through these last several verses. And I want you to notice that where in verse 18 it talks about someone offering a burnt offering, whether it's a vow or a votive offering, our study of Hebrew words for these offerings now comes in handy. Because starting with verse 21, when it begins to speak of an offering for another sacrifice, we're not just getting a repeat of what God just finished saying a moment ago. Each of these are different kinds of sacrifices, each with their own purposes, each with their own protocol, each with their own requirements of exactly what the sacrificial offerings to consist of. And it is no coincidence that there are five classes of sacrificial offerings and five classes of people who have laws about eating those sacrificial offerings. It's no coincidence. The first group of offerings in verses 18 through 20 are all based on what's called the olah, sacrifices. And the second group, verses 21 and 22, are based on the shelamim, sacrifices. And of course, God makes it clear that no defect can appear on the animals. And this is a perfectly parallel list that also disqualifies a priest from offering a ritual, sacrificial ritual. Now clearly, both the sacrifice and the sacrificer must be without blemish. The sacrifice also must come from a certain group of animals. Therefore, the sacrificer must come from a certain group of people, the Levite priests. And we saw earlier how Yeshua precisely paralleled this pattern. He had to be a blemish-free sacrifice, and he had to come from a certain group, the tribe of Judah, and he had to be the perfect priest of a certain type. He had to be of the order of Melchizedek, not the order of Aaron. In other words, not the order of Levites. Now, I also want to take this opportunity to point out another principle that's laid out so very well, but it's so easily overlooked. It says in verses 24 and 25, that not only must Israel not use for sacrifice any defective animal from its herds, but they can't use foreign animals that have those same defects. Notice there is no prohibition against using foreign-raised animals for sacrificing. It's only they have to meet the same standard. And here's the thing. The principle is that the requirements for presenting to God that which is accepted to God, acceptable to God, it's universal. It doesn't matter if the source is Hebrew or Gentile. Perfection is always the requirement. Always. Israel doesn't get a break on this requirement, and Gentiles don't get a break on this requirement. This is a doctrine that Paul taught so diligently in the various books of the New Testament. Before God, from a spiritual point of view, all humanity is the same. And when it comes to the requirements for being in his presence, we're all the same. And when it comes to what is good and evil, clean and unclean, right and wrong, fair and unfair, just and unjust, holy and impure, perfect and imperfect, it's all the same for everybody at all times. Don't be deceived. If the requirement to be acceptable to God is the same for all, and in our era that requirement is to trust in Messiah Yeshua, do you really believe that the rules and ordinances that define good and evil, clean and unclean, just and unjust, and all that are different for different groups, different for you than everybody else? Oh, it's a sin for you, but it's not a sin for me. Don't believe that Jehovah has plan A for the Jews and plan B for you, a Gentile. He does not. God doesn't have one Torah for the Hebrews, another Torah for the Gentiles. But it sure seems that the institutional church says so, doesn't it? the New Testament for Gentiles. The Old Testament is for Jews. But God doesn't say, well, Hebrews, look, you have to be very strict on following the principles of my Torah, but you Gentiles, make it up as you go. Whatever feels good to you. You feel it's right in your heart, have a ball. Jews have no latitude. No latitude. Gentiles, we don't have any boundaries. In essence, is that not the implication that we hear all the time from the pulpits? Torah is irrelevant for Gentiles. It's alive and well for the Jews. Chapter 22 winds down by giving us a couple of ordinances regarding just how young a sacrificial animal can be, and it is from the eighth day of its birth and onward that it becomes suitable for presenting it to God. Interesting that the requirement for Hebrew boys being circumcised, which is precisely symbolic of being presented to God, is the same. They undergo a Brit Milah, circumcision ceremony, on the eighth day after their birth. Next, we see that no animal may be killed on the same day its mother is killed, and vice versa. This is generally regarded as simply an instruction to be merciful and humane. And finally, God reminds us all of just who He is. He is holy. He is the one who's redeemed us. No one else is capable. He redeemed us, however, for a purpose. He wants us to be our God. And I want to wrap things up today by saying that the principles we continue to learn throughout Leviticus and then the whole Torah are either referred to or repeated throughout the New Testament. More than half of the words, hear this, more than half of the words of the New Testament are simply quotes taken directly from the Old Testament. And it was the patterns and the principles that we're studying in Torah that Jesus elevated to all of their highest spiritual intent. Jesus didn't break the mold. He perfected it. All these requirements of Leviticus that only priests could approach God, which I think seems kind of unfair to us sometimes, and that priests couldn't bury their dead in some cases, all of that's brought forward to the New Testament. Listen to 1 Peter 2:5 and 2:9. In 2:5, you yourselves as living stones are being built into a spiritual house to be priests, set apart for God to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to Him through Yeshua the Messiah. 2:9, but you are a chosen people, the king's priests, a holy nation, a people for God to possess. Why? In order for you to declare the praises of the one who called you out of the darkness into His wonderful light. That's why. And that's why I want you to sign up for that list and go out and be part of the team that lets everybody else know about Jesus, about Yeshua, and come in out of the darkness into the light. That's our job. That's your purpose. That's my purpose. As a believer, you are a priest. The only way one can be a priest is as a believer. There aren't believers who aren't priests. There aren't priests who aren't believers. Stack it any way you like it. Now pay attention to Luke. In 14:26, he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father, his mother, his wife, his children, his brothers and sisters, yes, his own life, he can't be my Talmud. He can't be my disciple. Nothing but nothing can be above God and His calling for your life. It is, if it's sadly necessary, you have to be separated from everything you are closest to on earth to follow Him, then so be it. the words of Luke or Jesus talking. Matthew 8:21. Another of the disciples said to him, "Oh, but sir, first let me go and bury my father." But Yeshua replied, "Follow me. Let the dead bury their own dead." Priests ordained by Christ are to emulate the priests of Israel. Just as the temple priests couldn't deal with dead things, neither should believers. Of course, as with all Yeshua's teachings, he is raising the Torah rules to their full spiritual purposes. The examples of Torah are physical demonstrations of spiritual purposes. This is not saying believers shouldn't participate in funerals. Rather, it is drawing the distinction between those who are willing to forsake everything to follow Christ so as to gain life versus those who insist on clinging to the ways of tradition and all they gain from it is death. And we'll begin chapter 23 next.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.